This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm interviewing Brian O'Leary, who runs a consulting entity called Magellan Media Consulting Partners. How are you, Brian?
I'm doing really well. Thank you, Dave.
Thanks for talking to me today. So Magellan is a kind of independent consultancy. Can you talk a little bit about the, you know, your background in the book business, how you got started, and what you did before today?
Sure. I'm actually perhaps a little bit unusual for the book business in that I've worked in both books and magazines, and people sometimes raise their eyebrows one or the other. I started out coming out of business school working for the weekly magazines at Time Inc. I did that for about 12 years, mostly on the production manufacturing side. And after that, took a job with a Map and Atlas publisher. So if you can imagine a world in which I went from putting out an entirely new publication every 7 days to a world in which cartographers who make decisions in glacial time were ruling the roost.
Right, so you were at both ends of the spectrum.
It was a big difference. And then shortly after leaving Hammond, about 11 years ago, started Magellan. And we're a consulting firm that works in the realm of faster, better, cheaper, essentially optimizing cross-platform content workflows and occasionally answering other questions that people ask me.
So are most of your clients are publishers?
All of them are publishers. They're either book or magazine publishers. But I also specialize to a certain degree in association publishing. They're very frequently both books and magazines together, which makes it a nice fit for my background.
Right, which makes sense.
And they're also quite often significant publishers without a lot of in-house publishing expertise.
Right. Well, and I assume that you could be fairly busy today, given the range of your expertise, because things have been changing so rapidly. People in business. Need to keep up, and it's almost impossible to keep up with everything that you need to know.
True of consultants as well. It's a brilliant career move, 25 years in the making.
Right, but you don't have 25 years to learn everything you need to know.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, so on your website, which I've been reading through and find pretty interesting, which is MagellanMediaPartners.com, you mention under projects. Three things, or research actually, but there are three areas, and I want to, if we have time, we'll try to talk about all of them, because I think each of them has is a good launching point for a conversation. One of the things that you've done research on, which I think is kind of unusual for the book business. We often hear about ideas and suppositions and things going on, and then you find out there's no research of any kind to prove the point or not. But you've done work in the relationship between pirated content and free distribution. And I'd really like to talk or hear you talk about that, because I think a lot of people just make the assumption it's a zero-sum game, and if content is pirated, that means sales will be negatively impacted. And I guess my question to you is, did your research support that supposition or something else?
Well, I'll give you the top line and then the nuance after that. The top line is that for a relatively limited sample set, we're currently looking at O'Reilly Media and Thomas Nelson front list titles, and we have active piracy data on the O'Reilly Media front list titles because we've been looking at them longer, so we found more of them. In fact, we found a cohort that has been pirated. But for that cohort that's been pirated, we've actually found that, if anything, there is an increase in paid content sales after piracy occurs. You would expect there to be a decline or perhaps an acceleration of the decline,
right,
in a natural sales curve. And the correlation that we have right now, not causation necessarily, is that there's actually a significant growth. And I'll talk a little bit more about that after I explain the methodology.
Yeah, that would be good.
What happened was, about a year and a half ago, the folks at O'Reilly, particularly Andrew Savickas and also Max Slocum, who was their Tools of Change editor at the time, he's now at Neiman. But Mac and Andrew came to me and said, and to Mike Shatskin, who they share an office with, and asked, is there some way to measure the impact of piracy on paid content sales? And we scratched our heads and thought about it for a while. And I went back to Mike and then eventually to the folks at O'Reilly and said, well, how about we treat it as if it were a marketing expense? And typically for co-op marketing, you would look at the sales in a quiet period before a promotion occurred, so say 4 weeks before, and then you'd look at the sales during the promotional period, and then you'd look at the sales after, typically for 4 weeks. So I said, if we compared the 4 weeks before piracy occurred to the 4 weeks after, that would at least be a starting point to say, is there an impact of this? So we started doing the two things. We took the O'Reilly front list to the fall of 2008 and just started looking for content that had been uploaded in some way or seeded in some way, shape, or form on piracy sites. And we started to see that. Some cases it occurred almost immediately, like 4 weeks out. And in some cases it took much longer. I think the longest lead time we've waited so far is 45 weeks after pub date, so almost a year. But one of the big surprises was there was a notion within O'Reilly that their editors thought everything that they published was pirated as soon as it was released. And what we found was that on average, there was a period of about 19 or 20 weeks between pub date and when content was first seeded on one or more peer-to-peer sites. So that was kind of interesting even on its own. Because there was this notion that it was being thrown out into the pirated universe almost immediately.
Right. Sort of sobering to realize that it isn't.
It does occur, but it also did not occur across their entire list. So we had a cohort of both pirated and unpirated, or we don't know what to call it, non-pirated titles. Now, one thing that's really important to mention is that, you know, from the point of view of this study, we really think that intellectual property matters. But the point of view that we were trying to test was that there's a hypothesis that there are niches and titles for which piracy is a direct loss and enforcement makes sense. The go-to example on that, although we've not tested it, is education titles, higher education titles. Small market, high price point, greater incentive to steal, and also to a greater incentive to do it in a very narrow time frame. But we also think that there may be niches or titles for which piracy may help spur paid sales. And what we were trying to do and continue to try and do in the study is not to say piracy helps or piracy hurts, but where might piracy be helping and what does it or hurting and what can we do about it. So it's the equivalent, I would say, is Thomas Edison's adage that he doesn't trust a man who salts his food before tasting it. This is research to essentially tell you what the food tastes like before you start salting it.
Mm-hmm, right. Well, and of course, if the result is that in certain niches piracy increase, again, we can't say causality for sure, but if there is piracy and at the same time there's an increase in sales, then the way of testing that would be to encourage piracy to see if increased piracy increases sales further.
Well, one of the things that we tried to because I've given a presentation on this at three different periods. One was the Tools of Change at the beginning of this year, Book Expo in May, and then most recently a Tools of Change Frankfurt conference in October. And I kept trying to come back to the notion that free, as it relates to book content, is not new. I mean, there's a long and I think very successful history of publishers giving away content to promote sales. I mean, if you think about ARCs or advanced reading copies or galleys, blabs, etc., there are a variety of different instances in which publishers have used sometimes full vote copies of existing works, given away to promote awareness and trial, generally among the trade.
Right. I think that the difference, of course, that most publishers would say is that the carry-on, the carry-on capability of non-digital free books is much lower than it is in a digital universe, where what they're afraid of is that if I give you a hardcover or a hard copy ARC, you might read it, and then maybe you're going to go to the Strand and sell it, and somebody else could read it. So I might have lost a sale or two, but if you digitize it and post it, and it becomes freely available for large numbers of people, what they're afraid of is that will poach a larger number of sales.
And I think that that's the kind of concern that we wanted to test. And
right.
Because I agree with you that there's that is an element of the fear that exists today. And one of the things that we found, the Seeds and Leeches, which is the not quite equivalent, but the peer-to-peer universe of uploads and downloads, Seeds we typically tracked for, they would peak for almost all the titles that we looked at. They would peak in the third week after content was uploaded. So the, and they would generally peak at a relatively low volume. I mean, the most we saw at any given time among Seeds was about 43 Seeds. And the average was something along the lines of 12. So you're talking relatively small numbers in this universe. And interestingly, Leeches never exceeded 13, and they peaked in week 2, and then relatively quickly dropped below 3 or 4 in weeks after that. So it was kind of like a book being released, in a sense. You know, there's a rush to go to the store to get a new book, whether hardcover or not. And then it relatively quickly quieted down. It was kind of searched, you know, onto the new. There wasn't like a growing and pervasive volume of either Seeds or Leeches that extended for a significant period of time. And that seemed pretty consistent across all the titles that we tracked. The other thing, as I mentioned a moment ago, is that the lag time was relatively long. I mean, you're talking almost 5 months before some of this, on average, the titles showed up.
Yeah,
and that kind of surprised us.
No, I think that surprises me, too.
So we thought, you know, we're going to keep at that, and we now are looking at a total of about 24 titles that have been pirated from the O'Reilly front list. And what we found was that, on average, there was a range of results. So one title, the best performing title, gained about 15% sales in the four-week period after, and the worst-performing title lost about 49%. And one of the things that was beginning to bother us when we looked at the data is we thought maybe we aren't accurately capturing the impact of a declining sales curve. So you sell a book in, it's going to decay after that initial peak at a not necessarily a reasonably predictable rate, particularly when you look at cohorts of titles. So we wanted to know what's the slope of the line going down so that we don't sort of over-account for the decline in sales.
You mean the slope of the line of a regular non-pirated book?
Yeah, and so we wanted to know what would you normally expect, or what was the rate of decline in the 4 weeks before, for example,
right,
if you were looking at pirated books, and the 4 weeks after. If it's naturally declining at 5% a week, you at least want to work that in somehow to the methodology.
Right, so you kind of exclude that from the effect of the piracy or lack of it.
So when we went about doing that, and the first thing we did is we normed everything to a common start date, meaning that because books are published every week of the year at O'Reilly, we put everything in week one, independent of when it was published. And then we looked at the sales rate for both non-pirated and pirated titles. And the thing that was interesting was the non-pirated titles followed that kind of, you know, relatively predictable curve of peaking after about 6 to 7 weeks and then declining fairly steadily over a long period of time, throughout the period of time that we were measuring. What we found with pirated titles is, and we don't think there's any significant difference in the sales profile. They sold a little bit less on average per book. We don't take anything away from that because we're looking at small samples. But like the pirated title or non-pirated titles, the pirated titles peaked early and then declined at a rate that was a little bit less than what we saw in the non-pirated titles. I don't take a lot from that. But then just a little bit before the 19-week mark, you can see in the plotted diagram that the sales actually on average grew, and it peaked higher than the peak on average that had occurred after initial sell-in. So from trough to the second peak was an increase of about 108%. And from the 19-week mark to the second peak was an increase of about 90%. So it was pretty noticeable, and it was the kind of thing that, you know, so you'll see a lot of noise in the data, and sales in any given week will bump up or down by some, not necessarily predictable, but random amount. This was a significant ramp up in average sales, much more so than we could explain by simply saying it's a natural variation. And you see it both in the week-to-week sales as well as in the four-week rolling average.
So what I guess I'm leaping to the conclusion then that you can draw, because of the pattern that you're seeing, that in fact the piracy can be shown to have increased sales at that point, because it's isolated to that.
I would love to have both more publishers and more data points before saying that. I mean, if you asked me to make a hypothesis, to say what would you think is going on, I would say what you just said. However, my job isn't in part in this research is not to prove it,
right?
Based on limited data, but really to just continue to get more publishers to join in, share their data, and approach it in a structured way that lets us begin to examine what really might be going on.
Right. Well, no, obviously, as a researcher, you have an obligation also to the context and to your methodology. But for somebody, and again, of course, there is a temptation to draw conclusions from limited data too quickly too readily, which I probably could be as guilty of as anybody. But it is very interesting.
It provokes some strong reactions, particularly at Frankfurt. I think people objected to this, what they considered a skew in the data. And what I said quite simply was, as you've already put your finger on, correlation is not causality, and we're not claiming it as such, and that larger data sets may uncover a sample skew that we don't see right now.
Right. But it becomes an interesting discussion point. It means that you can't just automatically make an assumption one way or the other. You really do have to, it's kind of evidence of what is required, that we need more data in the book business overall. I mean, I think that's one of the things that, for many people who are trying to figure out what is happening now, where are things going in the future, we have to make judgments about that with too little data. One thing I actually, just to change the subject a little, because I think this sort of leads into another area, I've thought a lot about the effect of natural resource issues like energy cost, pollution cost, the carbon footprint of publishing, to try to figure out whether there is a, over time, as natural resources become more pressured, whether that will change the way books are conceived. They'll be looked at as a highly polluting, highly energy utilizing, highly carbon footprint entity. And I wanted to look at comparing that to e-publishing in electronic forms. And I discovered, at least I've found so far, almost no data. We don't know what the energy cost of books is. We don't know what the pollution cost of books is. And we really don't know what the carbon footprint of books is. And it becomes impossible to determine whether, in fact, the supposition is correct. And I guess I'm trying to find out if you're interested in this whole issue of data in the book business, because obviously you do research.
I am, and it's interesting because, having worked in both magazines and books, I always found the magazine industry to be somewhat light when it comes to understanding data. The MPA does a pretty good job, but it's not the most nuanced stuff. But by comparison, they're light years ahead of the book business. And it's just astounding to me how little coherent data the book business has. And if I may go out a little bit on a limb, it also astounds me how strongly held the opinions are based upon the absence of data.
Right. Well, that is something that we probably have mutually observed in various contexts, that it's almost as if you could draw a correlation. The less data, the more strongly people feel about their ideas.
I think that's true, and it's funny because I know I don't have a strong feeling about piracy. I have some basic working notions, including that the business model that you want to follow should probably embrace a lot of different scenarios, and then you should be testing around them.
I think that makes sense.
I guess because I'm rooted in data, I have far fewer opinions.
Just thinking about the future, because obviously, that is a concern for most people who are trying to exist in the book business. They're sort of navigating the present, thinking about the future and how they will be able to navigate the changes that are underway. I don't want to put you on the spot, but would you care to predict how you think the evolution is, what kind of, rate of change in the print media? I know you've done studies also of print on demand. The thing that's sort of most commonly being talked about right now is how will e-publishing evolve and affect print publishing? And I'm just curious to know if you have any thoughts about that.
I probably have three, or at least two thoughts, or maybe one data point. One is that I think trade publishing or print publishing right now is built upon generally models that involve intermediaries. So the trade publishers, for example, sell to Amazon and Barnes & Noble or Borders, and et cetera. And there are a variety of other models like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an era in which I think the role of intermediaries is either going to be value added or that they're going to start moving up or down the food chain. And, Jeff Jarvis does a really good job in his book, What Would Google Do?, of dissecting how publishing, among other industries, needs to change because it's overly dependent upon intermediaries for whom other technologies, including the availability of information through search engines like Google, can make direct sales far more tenable in the future. So one of the things that I think is potentially going to happen is that publishers are going to have to start looking at the reader far more than they do looking at the trade and figuring out, how do they do things in concert so that both entities survive or that they recognize that both entities aren't going to survive and they take action accordingly.
I think you've stated it very profoundly. That's really, it's well put. I'm glad that we're recording because often I hear things, that I really want to, I think this is really right and I want to remember them. So it's nice to know that.
I'm glad you think so. The second is, it's a parallel to that. I grew up in New England in Massachusetts and where it was typically in the winter cold enough to go skating. And my dad, when he was teaching me how to ice skate, you probably, if you've ever seen kids learning how to skate, they typically, when they start to lose their balance, flail enormously.
Yeah, I was that kind of skater.
And we all probably were. And my dad's advice to me at the time was just fall.
Right.
He says, you don't get hurt by falling. You get hurt by trying not to fall. And the parallel I'd use here for book publishing in general is that if the model isn't working, working really hard to defend it is a mistake because you put all your efforts into essentially shoving, Hans Brinker like plugging holes in the dike.
Right.
And you don't really spend the time and energy finding out, to just fall and say, okay, what did I learn from this? So I think that we have to be very aware these days that the more effort we put into preserving the model as it currently exists, the less energy, the less resources, and ultimately the less time we have to fix or develop the alternatives that will work. And I'm afraid that publishing has particularly among the bigger players, focused on preserving the model rather than recognizing that some aspects, maybe most aspects of it, will fall and to adjust accordingly.
Right, which is what the record companies actually did too. Essentially, spending all of their energy trying to save their model, including suing their customers, which proved to be somewhat of an error.
Yeah, and there are aspects of that, although there's not an effort right now by either the AAP or the PA, Publishers Association in the UK, to to sue, enforcement is their primary objective, and they have no data. And even the data that they have about what they estimate the loss to piracy to be is not verifiable in a way that I would be comfortable even repeating the number.
Right.
And I think that it's not that I wouldn't enforce, but I would say enforcement in general to me should be limited to instances in which you clearly are showing, can show a loss, and that shouldn't be that hard to figure out.
Right.
I use education as an example. And the second thing I'd say, and this is the third point, it's related to the just fall, is if you're going to put up a bulkhead, if you're going to put fingers in the dike and use enforcement as your alternative, recognize that it's not going to last forever. The problem is that you have holes in the dike. And you either you can't fix the hole simply by chasing everybody. You have to recognize that maybe you need a different dike, or you need to let the level of the water down or something different.
Right. It's not a long-term strategy to stand in front of the dike with your fingers in the holes.
And I'm afraid that in some cases, even people that I work with and respect a great deal, that's kind of where they're going with this. We're speaking at the end of a week in which certain publishers have elected to delay the release of e-books. And there's a lot of howling about it, but I think I'd break it down into people who, on one side, individuals and entities who want to preserve the existing trade model, and on the other side, people who care about readers. And it's not that the publishers don't care about readers, but they're working on the model. And I think ultimately readers prevail. And if you don't meet their needs, then you don't survive either.
Right, because they will go elsewhere. The customer ultimately...
Reading is too hard. It's already hard enough to read,
right,
as opposed to watch a movie. You don't want to do anything to make it harder.
Right, and the world has gone to a place where customers have so many choices that if you don't satisfy their needs, they'll go somewhere else where someone does.
You know, it's an interesting thing. You mentioned print-on-demand as one of our research areas. It was in 2008, there was an inflection point. The number of units of books produced by using on-demand technology for the first time exceeded those using conventional press run technologies.
That, I think, is very profound.
It is, and what's interesting is it's not just, vanity is a relatively small piece, but some of the self-publishing for sale units have gone up a lot, as well some traditional or conventional publishers are using on-demand technology. Ultimately, though, if publishers are moving into a world, and they have to, if you step back and think about it, from the reader's or the author's perspective, if your publisher is not really marketing your book, I mean, most books don't get a tremendous amount of support. They get a few thousand dollars in either in co-op money or marketing support or an author tour, and they're not printing it. They're not creating an inventory. They're not putting the financial commitment up front. And I think a lot of authors would also argue they don't really get the editorial support that they might. That comes from agents or even from the authors themselves. At that point, if all they're doing is essentially stuffing the channel, then any author would reasonably ask themselves, is it worth me giving up, say, 35 margin points or 40 margin points? If I could get, 50% of the sale price of this book by doing it directly, and I do it on demand, versus 15%, and maybe less if it's an ebook. I think one by one, savvy and engaged people will start to ask themselves, can I do this on my own? Do the tools exist for me to support it?
Well, I think we will see that happening over time. I think on that note, though, we have to end this, as I think we've run out of time. But I really appreciate talking to me, and I think it's been really interesting, and I really enjoyed doing this with you.
No, me too.
Thanks, Brian. Brian O'Leary of Magellan Media Partners. This is David Wilk for Publishing Talks.